How far did we get last time?
We got to verse 21, I think.
I have something I wanted to bring up on verse 16.
Yeah.
Okay, now in my book, NASB, it doesn't have the same word, but in the King James and the New King James, it's the workmanship and the color of beryl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I looked up the word color, and that means eye. And this is the definition that I got for that. It's to afflict in the sense of something acted upon by an outside force, as an eye is by light. And then it says a wide variety of applications centered around the functions of the eye and the extension of those functions. And the reason I brought it up was because, you know, I think you said that the wheel, inside the wheel, there were different ideas as to what that would look like.
Yeah.
And this kind of opened things up for me when it said the eye, the workmanship, and it's talking about the color or the eye of the beryl, and how an eye is round with the cornea in the middle, you know, and the way it operates is it's sensitive to light. It'll open and close, mm-hmm. and it allows things in, and, you know, and discerns what it sees and things like that. And I was thinking that could possibly be a kind of an indication more as to what the wheels look like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are many different ideas on what that is, but that I was very surprised because mine doesn't say anything about color or here either. It says that what does it say, the 16, the workmanship was like the sparkling beryl, and so it was, and I also looked up beryl to try to find out what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in the library. I got pictures of beryl, and it's like a geode, and you can get several different colors out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them are amber, and some of them are green, and mm-hmm. whatever. But the one with the amber, it showed a picture of the amber, and it was like an eye. I mean, it actually had a dark spot in the middle of there.
Like so iris, iris for the pupil.
Yeah. And so I was thinking, wow, I wonder if that could be like that. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. Because to me, this is pretty fascinating, this whole thing here, you know.
Uh-huh.
And everything, and trying to figure out what in the world. It was, the appearance to him, of course, was overwhelming, but to us it is too.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to explain it and stuff.
I think the word for beryl is also, some people think it's topaz.
Yep.
So that'd be a different mineral.
There's several stones that fall into the beryl.
Yeah.
Category.
Yeah.
Aquamarine.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I
ruby.
That's what I found out.
Oh.
So, you know, it's like a geode. Is that what a beryl would be? Like inside
a
geode?
Well, a geode is a hollowed out. Yeah, it's got crystals in it.
So. Yeah. That's why I was thinking that maybe it would be like a rock, like a geode, and you open it up or you look inside of it, and there's this precious gem inside of it. So it would be several. Could be
a different color.
Yeah.
Different stone. Yeah. I have aquamarine.
Oh,
yeah. Rock.
You should bring it. Okay. Is it pretty clear? You know, like is it sparkling?
No, it's not a high quality one. It's kind of like a rod shape. You come out of the ground that way. Faceted around it. But long rod.
Hmm.
Different thicknesses, of course, and different color, different clarity.
Mm-hmm. And that same word for eye can often mean spring, to like a spring of water.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So the same word is used to mean different things in different contexts.
Yeah.
So it's like.
So when it says like sparkling burl, like sparkling spring.
It could be mean like water in a spring.
It also way down in the list on this and in the lexicon, it had color was down there, but it was almost at the very end of the whole thing. I don't know. Does that establish priority?
No, it doesn't. It does reflect the frequency of appearance in all of the Bible, but the context, you know, usually like if you look at, depending on which lexicon you're looking at, for each of the possible meanings, they'll give example passages. And so one of the things you want to do is to look to see if the passage you're at is
usually
one of the examples. Yeah, often it's not. It just depends. If it's an area where it's real tricky, often it will be one of the ones that they list, but not always, yeah. So you're kind of left with having to look at how that word is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, like if you have a computer program or even the Strong's, you can do a search to see where that word is used elsewhere. So, you know, there's a lot that the other thing I would do is to look at other English translations as well, four or five that I would say are real reliable that I typically check, and then that will kind of help you from getting too far astray, because there you've got people who are really well versed with Hebrew in translation committees, and if they never render it color, say, or most of them don't render it color, they render it something else. But if you have a particular idea you think it is and none of them render it that way, then it's a pretty big flag to be cautious. Just because it's in the list doesn't necessarily mean that the context favors that interpretation. But yeah, there's a lot of art to it.
Yeah, that was interesting. You go through that, well, I wonder what this means. I'm always going back into the back, but this was totally different. I mean, cover and eye, you know.
Yeah, they're a lot different as far as, that's the whole thing I've talked about before, where I don't have the exact phrase, but it basically says translators are traitors. because every time you translate, you lose some accuracy, and it's not so much that you don't get to the right corresponding word, it's just that each word in the original and each word that you go to in the translated language don't have the exact same range of meaning. That's where you get into trouble, because in the source language, Hebrew or Greek, the word might have a certain range of meaning, and then in the target language there's a range of meaning, and they overlap where the words correspond, but when you look at the borders of where those ranges go, they extend, like in the English, it'll extend somewhere that the Hebrew doesn't include, you know. So like a good example, and one I bring up quite frequently, is in John 3:16, where it says, "For God so loved the world." The "so" there, in the English, most frequently has the idea of so much, but in the Greek, the word for "so" there is not talking about degree; it's talking about in this way. Mm-hmm. So when people look at that verse and they read the "so" as meaning so much, they're taking the English term into an area that doesn't overlap what the Greek.
Yeah, that's what I always thought it was.
Yeah, and you can see from the context, because it says as the Son of Man would be lifted up. You know, so when you look at what's really being said in that passage, you can see that it's essentially saying that God demonstrated his love for the world. This is the way he demonstrated it. And his demonstration shows he loves the world a lot. You don't want to lose that idea, right? That is conveyed in the passage, but that's not the central focus of that phrase. It's this is the way in which God loved the world. And how did he show that? He showed that by giving his only begotten Son. So that's a good example. Or another one that'd be real trivial, that's obvious, is there's sometimes where the English word touching means concerning. You know, touching this or touching that. You know, British would say such and such, touching this or touching that or concerning. And then an American would think, well, touching just means physically touching, right? And so there have been situations where where some preachers have misused the King James, you know, where it talks about touching, and they've misused that to teach physical touch when the passage itself isn't talking about physical touch at all, right?
Yeah.
So you get these situations like that where, so you have to kind of be careful, and that's where looking at the other English translations kind of helps put a tether on. So you kind of go from your single translation to looking at Strong's, and when you get to Strong's, there's this world of possibilities. And you need to kind of, there's situations where some of those possibilities aren't really accurate for that passage. And that's where looking at the reliable English translations will kind of put a circle around what's really realistic. And if you're outside that circle and you're not an absolute expert on Hebrew or Greek, then, you know, you're really on thin ice. You're not really.
So what you're saying is when I look at this thing and I see the Hebrew word means eye.
Or spring, yeah, primarily.
Yeah, that's what it was in Strong's when I looked it up there. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't necessarily mean the working of the eye or the looks of the eye.
Not
or anything like that.
No, well, there's other places where it means...
Since they translated it color.
Right.
And this one translated it sparkling. Okay, so... So that leads you in a different direction.
Yeah, leads you in the direction of appearance rather
yeah.
than literal eye or literal spring. So there's other passages where it appears all over the place and it's spring, you know, spring of water. It's not eye at all. So, yeah, you have to kind of look at people who are translating this are they're looking at the grammatical construction of the sentence. You know, they're looking at how Ezekiel uses the word throughout the passage, and they're also looking at its use in the Old Testament. I mean, they're looking at a lot of things. So they're generally a lot better equipped than we are, but still you will see, you know, like when we compare, you know, King James with the NASB or the NIV or the ESV or the HCSB, there's various ones that are, you know, they're all reasonable translations. And you'll see certain places where they're like lining up down the road and they hit one word and they go boink,
mm-hmm.
you know. And yeah, and
yeah.
and those are places where there's legitimate differences of opinion about. I mean, there's two times that happens. In the Old Testament, it usually happens because there's just a difference of opinion about how something should be translated. And this is especially true when it comes to, this isn't the case here because this word isn't a gem, but when you get to some of the gemstones or some of the animals, the less frequent or uncommon animals, you'll see, you know, a rock badger, or you'll see, you know, a manatee or a dolphin, or, you know, you'll see things that are quite different. Unicorn in the King James, you'll see. So you have to kind of, in those cases, I think, sometimes it's the obscurity of the Hebrew phrase. And then in the New Testament, where you see the differences, sometimes it's they're following different manuscript families where there is a variation in a word or a phrase, you know, and they disagree over which one's the better one.
I looked at the word before that, it said workmanship, and so I felt, well, this probably relates to how it works, you know, and so that's why I was inferring into it, that
mm-hmm.
this particular portion here, which
right.
was the
yeah,
not necessarily mean that. So,
the beryl. It also says it's one of the gems that was in the high priest's breastplate.
Mm-hmm.
So that really gives it a real Jewish, but the high priest. So you could say, you know, high priest being, you could almost push it towards Christ being the high priest,
mm-hmm.
and, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we don't really have a color for the world. Yeah.
It's a class of stone.
A class of stone.
Yeah. Kind lots of different.
So when the Bible says beryl,
I guess there's aquamarine, topaz. I think rubies and emeralds fall into it.
Yeah.
Topaz comes in different colors too, though. Could be blue, could be champagne, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a I guess you get the whole color spectrum in that group.
Yeah, people have...
Well, I guess, I don't know geologists' terms, you know, they class as barrel form, and they define it down from there.
I was just trying to think, okay, what's another one that we know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's...
Well, you know more than you
know. Yep, that was me.
Yeah, yeah.
That confirmed what I was reading, because what I was reading was confusing.
Yeah, it's a complete range.
I expected to find one and stuff. Because somewhere I read that it was the second hardest.
They are hard, they're highest of
diamonds. And then they're the ones below all of that class.
The diamond's like a 10 or something, and then barrels are the 8.5 to 9 hardness range.
See, I've never found that diamond one.
We did think rubies are red, you know, you think topaz is yellow or something. That's what I always thought, but not so.
And I guess within that, like the aquamarine, the quality of it too. So it can be a richer, clearer blue
and
more central
peak.
Yeah, cloudier. Yeah. And emeralds are that way too. So that's another one I think is in the barrel.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So,
that was one
of the barrels.
I'm not
going
to buy it. Central Marine. Yeah, I thought it was. Total, that's a different. It's not as easy to understand what they're talking about.
Right.
You might think.
Okay, here's a, it's hard to read because this is a Kindle format, doesn't really come out real well, but this is a table in Revelation of the, whoops, I guess it moved, a table in Revelation that has a list of the 12 tribes and their stones, as well as some of the alternate translations. This will give you a feel for how much uncertainty there are on these stones, right?
The first, which one is Beryl? What tribe?
Zebulun. Okay, but so Beryl is, in the Old Testament, some people translate that topaz. And in the New Testament, again, these are Greek terms in the New Testament, right? So they're trying to correspond the Greek terms. And when they look at the Greek terms in the New Testament, you have Hebrew and the Old Testament, but there's a version of the Hebrew Bible that was translated into Greek by Jews early on, the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
So that translation isn't considered inspired in the same way as the original Hebrew, but it gives you a feel for the ancient Jewish translators, what they thought the equivalent Greek term was, right? Instead of modern Greek translators, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so they translate, some of them translate it chrysolite.
Mm-hmm.
But as you go along, you know, the first one, sardius, and some translations have it as ruby or carnelian. Second one's topaz, and some have it as chrysolite or beryl. You got carbuncle that some say is emerald, some say it's beryl, some say it's turquoise, some say it's carbuncle, which, you know, one. So, I'm not saying it's hopeless. I'm just saying there have been a number of people who've really studied it, and it's one of the gnarly parts to really nail down, just like the animals, some of the animals that when it talks about certain sorts of creatures that are unclean, you can, you know, it's like, You see three or four different translations, and they're just quite a bit different. And even when you go, like I've got several Jewish translations, you know, translated into English by Jews, rabbis, or the Jewish Publication Society, they struggle over it too. You know, it's not just us dumb Gentiles, you know, that the Jews themselves, you know, have trouble with it. So it's a tricky thing. It is, you can make a pretty good correspondence though, as far as like Sid was talking about, in the Hebrew, the term that's used for this stone, you can find that same term used for the stone in the breastplate.
Mm-hmm.
So you know you've at least got some correlation. You may not know in English exactly what stone that is, but you can make the correlation that this is one of the stones that's in the high priest's
And they were all different, so.
Yeah.
Know that, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, we know they're all different, and each one represents one of the tribes.
They can't all be carbuncle.
No.
Right.
Right.
So the ones that you, unless that's, you can nail down, yeah, and you go,
that's a class.
Oh, you can't use that over here. I already used here. Yeah. You know this one.
Yeah.
Process of elimination.
Yeah. So it's definitely fascinating. You know, and there you can also make correlations between the stones and tribes, you know, because there's correlations there. So, but anyway, it's definitely an area of interest and trickiness. But
so would they just mention, or they just say burl or barrel? That's kind of misleading, I would think.
Well, yeah, see, so here's what I would suggest is that if it's really referring to color, you know, which again, there's some question about that. If it's really referring to color, then originally in Ezekiel's time, when this term was used, it had a correlation to a particular color. And it may be that that was the primary color that they referred to with that particular name, that gem in the region of Israel. Now, I don't, you know, there's, because I think Mike used to this too. I mean, if you go into different areas, some of the same stones tend to have a certain color more in one region than another.
But modern science is the one that's come around and said all these stones fall into the barrel.
Yeah.
2,000 years ago, or more, 4,000 years ago.
Who knows?
Yeah. Right.
It's only today they say, oh, these are different ones fall into
the barrel. Biggest could be like spectrographic
first
analysis
picture
or something like that.
Yeah, mineral.
It was all gray. It just looked like a gray rock, you know. Mm-hmm. And so apparently the gem was inside this gray rock.
Yeah.
Well, and then the sparkling, because they use the word spark in ASD, I'm thinking like what you're saying is how pure, you know, translucent it is versus, you know, opaque, and so that's going to be a more valuable, pure, whatever.
Well, and then again, too,
I mean, if that is any
there, yeah, there's also the possibility that sparkling there might refer to the alternate view of the word, which is spring.
Right, because then it says down here, it says rushing waters,
mm-hmm.
you know, further on.
The sound, the sound, yeah. That's different, that's a sound, yeah.
Yeah, but you're talking about spring.
Yeah.
And it's talking waters here.
Right, and we're going to see,
you know,
the
so
sea of glass or, you know,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah, so I mean,
too.
It could be exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. So
it's an aquamarine spring.
And so apparently they didn't turn.
Mm-hmm.
The wheels didn't turn. They were just pressed on the ground and go and in a certain direction.
Yeah, and I guess it depends on what they mean by not turning, you know, because that may, you could say that they either don't turn at all, or it may be that they don't change their direction.
Right? Well, it says, without turning as they move.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They went in four directions without turning as they move. So
right.
That made straight. Then.
Well, maybe.
Could,
I mean, you know,
yeah.
if these wheels are, like we talked about the possibility last time, that they're actually, they go front and back and sideways at the same time, where the rims intersect each other, right? So you've got a wheel this way and a wheel that way, and the rims run through each other's rim.
Gyroscope.
Like a gyroscope,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not one within another. They're both the same diameter or radius, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that's a possibility, then that would talk about wheels could move in these four directions without turning this way.
Yeah.
Right, just like the four faces, like you were talking about, they fly and all, they're always staying in the same direction, but they can fly in any, and without turning their head, they've always got one face facing the direction they're going. So it, you know, it's a challenge to make sense of, for sure.
Yeah.
But you do get the definite feeling that he's trying to relate, not only is this, the vision of what he's seeing is really magnificent and unusual, but the way it moves is unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty wild. So we looked. So anything more that?
Remember my NASB did that thing about, you know, where it's that anticipation thing, you know, and I don't know what.
Oh, about you?
Yeah. Yeah, and how my translation really wasn't accurate.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't just jump and say it wasn't accurate. It was different.
Okay.
Yeah. You know.
But I forgot, these guys have New King James, so it wouldn't be an issue for them. But my,
I think your translation was accurate, except you weren't thinking of it in an accurate way.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think that's true.
No, really.
Yeah. Because there, it's definitely true.
I didn't bring it up. Yeah.
You know.
No.
It's kind of like, I mean,
what was the
degree,
word again? I forget.
It was in verse
20.
It said verse 20.
It's like wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction.
Wanted to go versus about to go.
Where were they?
Yeah, it was verse 20. David's right.
Yeah.
Yours said wherever the Spirit was about to go.
Wherever, you know, there was
no, it was
direction.
About to go, right?
That's
yeah, it was about to go.
Yeah, ours says wanted to go.
Right.
About versus wanted.
Mm-hmm. So mine was kind of like I was thinking that, you know,
that they were
anticipating,
right.
Which wasn't because they wanted to go that way, they went that way, and mine was, the Spirit is about to go that way, so therefore we'll jump and we will go that way. But it was this about business was giving me problems.
Right.
I don't know. I think if you like look at it all in context, the point is that the wheels don't move of their own
accord.
They're doing what the Spirit wants, or they're doing what the Spirit wills.
Yeah. And that was what my problem was. The way it was worded, it seemed like that was contrary to what I thought it should.
And that's where it's real helpful, I think, to look at some other reliable English translations.
In other words, switch to New King James.
No, I'm not saying that.
I'm not saying a particular translation.
I mean, there are particular ones that I think are better than others overall.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a handful of reliable translations where you can get a feel for the broader meaning of that Hebrew or Greek term without getting stuck on the particular English phrase they've given you. Because there's times where you can take an English phrase or an English word and just push it to the wall when it's not necessarily the right interpretation. Like I was mentioning in John 3:16, people take that so and they slap it to the wall. And you can find a million books telling you that so means the degree. And that's just not true. So that's where it's better if you can look at some other translations and you see, it could mean this instead. And then you look at the context and you realize, oh, yeah, the context really leans toward this.
Right.
Like Jerry was looking at this other word, the working. See, that's a good way to approach it, because you're not just looking at the word or the phrase on its own. You're looking at the whole setting that it's in.
Yeah, oh, I understood in the context. I was just trying to fit in how they were wording it into what I knew should be.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And actually, this didn't say working. It says workmanship, which is how it was made.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine says workings.
Yeah. Really?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was.
Yeah.
Wondering.
So when you get into passages that are mysterious, and you're really looking at them closely. It is a really good idea before you like really push hard in one particular translation that you look at a couple others that like I say are also like word for word fairly literal translations, and it'll alert you to other possibilities, you know, as far as the range of valid range of meaning for what you're looking at, and sometimes it can open your eyes to a whole different way of thinking about it than where you're kind of just stuck just looking at it. The other thing that comes into this too, not so much in the Old Testament, but more in the New Testament, is every time a translation is made, it's got a history before it. You know, like the King James was done after the Geneva Bible, and after Wycliffe did his translation, after Tyndale did his translation, You know, the NASB or the New King James, they're coming after other translations like the King James or, you know, the ASV and so on. And so the translators, if you look at different Bible translations, there's kind of certain streams that they, that they're, like the New King James obviously comes from the King James, which then goes back, you know, to the Geneva and Tyndale and so on. But so that influences the translators too. They where there's choices to be made for the subtleties of what a how you relate a phrase, unless they think there's really good reason for overthrowing the grandfather of what they're working with, they'll tend to stay with it, right? And so you'll see that as well, is even if there's some people in the committee that think really it should read this instead, unless they can make a really good case for it, chances are the status quo of the previous translation that this translation is kind of based on or similar to is going to kind of keep them from changing that. And then when it's a real familiar passage like John 3:16 or, you know, John 1 or something, then that even really constrains them because, you know, if you fool with one word in John 3:16, you'll never sell your Bible,
mm-hmm.
right? Because first thing that'll happen is you'll have half of Christianity saying that your work is of the devil because you tweaked one word. You know, so you have to keep that in mind, that it's this balance, because the body of Christ is completely sensitive to Satan gradually undermining God's word through all sorts of different avenues, and therefore we're paranoid about changes, and a lot of that paranoia is rightly invested in place, because we see what happens in seminaries, we see what happens with translations and the trends. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes we can be so overly focused that you know, we won't even allow for the variations that the Greek or Hebrew itself allows for, because we're just so stuck on it. And to me, that's where the King James only point of view crosses the line. People who believe that, you know, the King James is the only inspired English translation. What's that?
That's the way Jesus talked.
Yeah, he does in all the movies.
He looks like a white guy.
Yeah.
With blonde hair.
Yeah.
Translation, fun. Okay, so we talked last time about, I think, pretty much through verse 21, right? We looked at the fact that these creatures are there. Later we'll see in chapter 10, I think they appear again, and they're called cherubs there. Here they're called living creatures. There they're cherubs. And we saw similar living creatures in Revelation 4. Also in Isaiah 6, there's similar ones there. They're called seraphs, which is apparently a different category. Seraph means burning one, and cherub, there's different, a little bit different ideas about it, what it means. So you got these different categories of living creatures that are close to God's throne, and we also looked at how the four faces maybe correlate to four different characteristics of Jesus: the king, the servant, the man, and God, the four different faces. So, any questions on any of that before we actually go and start reading further? Or any comments about any of that? Okay. So, who wants to read like 22 through the end of the chapter for us?
That whole section is called Vision of Divine Glory. Now, over the heads of the living beings, there was something like an expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal spread out over their heads. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward the other. Each one also had two wings covering its body, on one side and on the other. I also heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of abundant waters as they went, like the voice of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army camp. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse that was over their heads. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. Now above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance, and on that which resembled a throne, high up, was a figure with the appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and heard a voice speaking.
Yeah. So we got these four creatures down with these wheels, and so then there's this up above them,
mm-hmm.
and then there's things up above that, right? So what's up above? Okay, yeah, there's a bunch of things up above, but one of the things it says is there's the appearance of a man. And that's probably the most amazing phrase in the whole book of Ezekiel right there. You know, and you know what's amazing about that is, like I mentioned I think last time, is when you go and, you know, man is made in God's image, and primarily we take that not to be physical, but other aspects of man, right? Like his intellect, creativity, morality, moral person, choices, freedom, all these other aspects which I think it generally is concerned with. And yet here's this image of a divine presence, and it says it's like a man. It talks about waist and feet and things like that. And then, you know, when we're in the Ten Commandments, of course, you know, in Exodus 20, and like if we go to Exodus 20, the second commandment, essentially, in verse 4, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, you know, etc. But part of this idea of, you know, he's primarily saying, don't make images to anything and bow down to them. And I think
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
I've come to that conclusion that I have made many carvings of animals and stuff. And
yeah.
But you're not bowing down.
I don't bow.
No. you know, I think you can't take verse 4 without verse 5. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think he's precluding artwork of nature by any means.
They had a purpose in making what they were doing.
Right,
he's
not talking about art.
To worship.
Yeah.
Not only that, I mean, in the temple there were lions out
mm-hmm.
in the front with them there,
mm-hmm.
and
cherubs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, when you read these first two commandments, you know, you shall have no other gods before me, and then he talks about not making images. There's always been this implicit connection, potentially, that he's also saying, you know, one of the reasons you can't make an image and worship an image is because there is no image that captures who I am or what I am, right? And God is spirit, and so there's this whole issue of anything you do to represent God by something you know is going to be inaccurate, so don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you see all the different things that the cultures have made to worship, mm-hmm. you know, they're all, you know, they're not God at all.
Yeah, so it's worshiping the creation, not creator.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what this is. It's representing the creation.
Right.
Which is what you're saying.
Yeah, and so, but what I'm also saying, though, is that, you know, when you look at the Ten Commandments and you think about it from like a Jewish perspective, the idea that you see this Ten Commandment that makes a really big emphasis on not making any representations of God. It's not just, I mean, I guess the way it's read, it's not just read like, don't make images of other things and bow down to them. There's the implication of don't make images of me either.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Don't make images because they're not going to be accurate. Even though this is literally just saying, you know, you shall have no other gods before me, so don't make images that are of other gods, is, you know, kind of what it's reading. But there's also been the implication, I think, when you read it, that, you know, making images is bad in general because you can't represent me with an image. Because, like you say, it's both. And so that's why when you get to the situation like this one in Ezekiel, and it's building up on this glorious thing, these animals, this fire, this cloud, this eyes, this magnificent beings, this crystal, this throne, this fiery this, and it gets up to what's on the throne, right?
Mm-hmm.
A likeness of a man.
Mm-hmm. It's likeness of, it doesn't mean it looks like. It's got a shape or something that looks familiar to him, but yet it's different.
Yes, the form of a man.
Couldn't
what it
means. Hmm? I know this probably sounds stupid, but couldn't it possibly be a chariot for the second, for God the Son?
Well, sure. And I think that's where we would go with it, ultimately.
That's where I went, but I think
especially with New Testament, some of the things in the New Testament, we have to go in that direction. You know, John 1:18 says, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him, or made Him known, or explained Him, or revealed Him, depending on the translation you take there." And then Colossians, "In Him, Christ dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily," and that bodily, that word there is soma. It's based on the Greek word soma. It's just talking about in bodily form, in appearance like a man. You know, you could almost read it, "In Him Christ dwells all the fullness of the Godhead in the appearance of a man," except you'd have to be really careful there because it's a lot more than the appearance. It is a literal man. It's not just the appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But so as a Christian, you know, reading Ezekiel, it's kind of a yawn. Oh yeah, it's a man on the throne, right? But as a Jew, you know, it ought to just like knock you out of your chair. And so, you know, so I went to my different Jewish translations of the Old Testament, the Jewish Study Bible, right? You know, and you think, man, you know, if anyone has insight on these passages, boy, the Jews are going to have it. You know, they can't figure out Isaiah 53, and you get to here, they don't even say anything about it.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh.
So they got comments on the verses, you know, you get to this, you know, various things about animals and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they say when it says the Almighty, that's El Shaddai, you know, the all-capable one, that's great. You get down to that verse where it says there's a likeness of a man, no entry in the notes at all.
I find that with the Study Bible.
Yeah.
I'll just skip that verse.
The hard,
I have a question. There's no comment about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's
a safe way to do it.
Well, yeah.
Kick
Yeah. And then I went to a different, I've got another one that's called the stone version of the Tanakh. Is just means the Old Testament, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, which is basically saying the law, the prophets, and the writings. But so the Tanakh is the Old Testament, the Jewish way of referring to it. And so you look at this passage in this one that was done by this very studious rabbi, and in his notes, skips the verse. So it's just like, and the thing that really frustrates me sometimes is because we're constantly accused, Christians are constantly accused by Jews of pouring their Christocentric nonsense into the Old Testament. You know, we're the ones that are taking passages and pouring Christ into them where he's not there, you know. And yet, here's a passage where it's got a man, essentially, the likeness of a man on this throne that's the glory of God, and it's clearly not an angel. There's not a hint of it of that being an angel in any sense, and they don't even try to spin it like an angel. They just like, mum's the word.
Wouldn't you refer back to, I think it's Deuteronomy 29:29, where the secret things belong to God, but the things revealed belong to us. And so if it's not revealed, that belongs to God. And let's leave it there and not try to make anything about it.
Well, sure. And so, but there's a sense in which there are aspects of the Old Testament that are hanging, that are mysteries, that the New Testament helps solve those mysteries, right? The additional revelation of the New Testament. And so, you know, like the passage, the Lord said to my Lord, right? So, who is the Lord and who is he speaking to? You know, the Lord of David. How can David's offspring be his Lord? Things like that. Okay, so those are, or in Proverbs 30, verse 4, it talks about God and it says, what is his name and what is his son's name, if you know. You know, so there's these things in the Old Testament, and in my view, this is one of those where you have, this isn't like just, you know, like you've brought up before, the Lord and two angels go to see Abraham, and that in itself is a difficult situation there. Mm-hmm. Not for us, but for Jewish things to explain. But when you come to this, you know, you're building up to this. This is God's throne. It's very clearly God's throne, and his, I mean, and it's, it taught, even the ones that are translating this, the Jews, they're talking about El Shaddai. And then here's this likeness of this man, you know. And so it's like, you guys, you Christians, you know, you're always trying to take this guy born of a virgin who is a man and make him into God. What a perversion of our Jewish Old Testament. That's basically how they approach it.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, well,
what does this mean?
What does this say? You know, it says the likeness of a man. You know, and the word there for man is one. There's several, but it's the one Adam. It's the likeness of Adam. It's the likeness of a man. In fact, when you read the opening part of Genesis, it's kind of funny in a way because it talks about God making man, and then it says Adam, right? But really, it's Adam. It's just that the translators decide partway through that it's supposed to be used as a proper name, right? So
when did Jesus get the likeness of a man? When did the Word get the likeness of a man?
Well, that he's always been the Son. He's
right.
Never, he was not incarnate until his birth.
And so, but this shows the likeness of man before,
right,
he
before
was incarnate.
Right. That's right.
Exactly. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like you pointed out before too, that the angel of Yahweh speaks in the first person as Yahweh.
Yeah.
And again, so this is another one of those situations that points in the direction of the Trinity that people don't want to see, that don't embrace the Christian understanding of the Bible, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what Calvin says.
What's he say?
Oh, I'll just read it. It says that solid or likeness of a human appearance. One noun ought to suffice, but because he was so prone to the vague and erroneous opinions, he joins the word appearance to a likeness. We see then that whatever the ancient, is that heretic, fabricated about the visible form of God is included by the clearest excluded by the clearest language. It is now asked why God put on the form of man in the vision as well as in other similar ones. I will willingly embrace the opinion of those scholars who say that this is the prelude to that mystery which was afterwards displayed in the world and which Paul magnificently extols when he exclaims, and that great is the mystery, God is manifested in the flesh.
Right, so the incarnation. Yeah, it's a precursor to the incarnation, yeah.
So these are little hints of what's going to come to the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. This whole thing too is like, it's the same thing you could use with Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, you know. What in the world is this form of a man doing on this throne, right?
Because when their eyes open, they'll look back to some of these and go, oh, you know, in hindsight,
mm-hmm.
they'll go, oh, it was here all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of thing.
Maybe.
It's like in Revelation, where in Revelation 1, where he says, I'm the Alpha and Omega, the first and last, I was dead and I am alive again. And you look up, well, how are those terms, the first and the last and Alpha and Omega, how are they used throughout the Bible? Who could that be? It's God. And he died. How did that happen? Again, so there's these, to me, this is one of those passages where we have to have a lot of patience, because there's this constant fight against the truth of Christianity that God became a man in the flesh, and part of that is the rejection of the Trinity,
mm-hmm.
concept of the Trinity, and so to me that's where it gets really irritating when you're talking with Mormons or something, and where you hear them witnessing like we did on the streets of Leavenworth, and they say things like, well, we're Christians too.
Mm-hmm.
BS, you're not Christians. You're not Christians. You deny the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is flat out dishonest.
Yeah, they have to say it, because I've said it, asked them that, because they said they came up one time and said, we're with Christian ministry. So I asked them, who is Jesus? Is he God? Is he man? Is he both God and man? Well, he was just a man. I said, well, we know now that you're not with Christian ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And that they left. So,
yeah, that's exactly the way to do it. It's,
yeah.
You know, and it upsets me that they don't understand who Christ is and that they're lost in this cult. And one of my best friends when I was growing up, I wasn't a Christian, but one of my best friends for years was a Mormon. And great, super nice family. But once I became a Christian, boom. You know, there was a lot of friction because I started talking about who Christ was. And he wouldn't handle that. But the thing about it is, it's one thing to be frustrated by that and see that, but when you start saying that you have my Jesus, and you're perverting the truth of the Bible, that's where I lose a lot of patience. It's not a chicken this time.
Sounds like a lion.
No,
a motorcycle.
Oh, motorcycle.
Yeah, the lion ate the chicken.
Yeah.
Always skip.
So if you want to be a Mormon, okay, be a Mormon, but be straightforward. This business that, like, well, we moved Mormonism from Saturday to Sunday essentially as a day of gathering, and now we're referring to ourselves as not just Latter-day Saints but Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is just plain subterfuge, and so when they like deny the Trinity, or you know, they want you to come to their church, well, why don't you come to my church? Why is it that you have a separate Mormon church?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, we're Christians too. So these are some of the passages you can go to, you know. But the thing is, like we've talked about before, you know, are people open to even to looking at these things and thinking about them? Because often they'll have answers for these things, but the answers just don't fly, you know. And that's where if they give their pat answer and they aren't willing to really look at what it says, then breaking through that is really, really difficult. You know, I remember one time, you know, somebody sent me an article by a fairly well-known rabbi where he has this whole long article where he talks about, you know, the Christians, they misrepresent what Jesus was teaching on the part where Jesus asked, you know, if David said, my Lord said to my Lord, you know, who is David? How could David's son be his Lord? And and they're saying, well, the word there is Adonai. And the word Adonai is never used for God the Father. It's just used as someone who's honorable, not for really for God. Well, that's just a blatant lie, you know. And so here you got this big, long article by this established rabbi, and it's completely flat-out wrong. You don't have to, you know, I mean, anyone with a strong can look up these passages that are talking about that can't be anything other than God. And even the Jews would say, this passage is about God. And you look up, what's the word there for Lord? It's Adonai. Mm-hmm. So you can pull out, you know, dozens of examples that contradict this guy. So the strength of the spiritual battle is just immense. You will see people who are really immersed in this stuff saying things that are like completely opposed to what the reading just has, you know. And like these, like the study Bibles I was just referring to by these Jewish guys, you know, they've got all sorts of comments about all sorts of things, but you get to some of the tough passages and they're just, and I've said this a lot of times, lame. You know, lame is a four-letter word. It's lame. And I think in some ways, you know, it's a mixed feeling when you look these things up, because on the one hand you're thinking, wow, I wonder what the Jews think about this. And then when you read it, it just blows your mind, because you can't believe that they would have nothing to say, you know.
But wouldn't you look at the fact that God temporarily blinded them, and wouldn't that enter into it? I mean, they're not able to make the connections because of God. I mean, some do, you know. I don't know how that works out, but as a nation, they're temporarily blinded, and so that would that's why I wonder about some of the believing Jews, but I won't get into that anymore. not the really, you know, but just it, because God's action was involved there. God did this, and of course God can do whatever God wants to do because it's God. But if for justice to be a just God, and I should say this because lightning struck or something, but you would think that if God caused something to happen, he wouldn't hold a person responsible for when it happens. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, that's Romans 9, right? I mean, that's what Paul says. Who can say he's resisted his will?
Yeah.
I mean, Paul brings that very thing up. And what does he say? He says, can the pot reply against the potter?
Yeah.
You know, why have you made me this way?
Yeah.
So Paul does.
Well, no, that's as if a person is has an objection to it. If a person doesn't even know what's happening.
Well, I mean, but he's just talking about the fact that he's talking about election there, and he's saying, you know, there is nobody who doesn't fulfill God's will, and therefore, if they're helping fulfill His will by rejecting, then how can He hold them responsible? And he essentially says, you know, that's a question that is in a realm that we can't go, I think is what he really is saying there. But I think it's right to bring that question up, because he brings it up. He addresses. He knows people have that question. I mean, it's a valid question, but ultimately, when we and that's the part that's so hard is because when we interact with people who can't see this stuff, some of the time we interact with them and it just seems like they're just blind. They just can't see it, and then we just think, well, they're blind. They can't see it. But other times there's a willful, strong opposition to the truth that is not passive in the least. It's very active. Like if you read the Jewish Study Bible, their discussion of Isaiah 53, where it talks about the suffering servant, you know, they present in there what Christians think, right? I mean, they're really well aware of what Christians think about it. It's not like they're blind to that possibility, but they reject it, and it's a willful rejection of the truth when the truth is even made, you know, somewhat plain. Of course, you can say that's blindness too, but all I'm trying to say is that it comes in so many different forms. You know, when Jesus uses this harsh phrase, the synagogue of Satan, which is really pretty harsh, right? I mean, Jesus in Revelation is calling these synagogues the synagogue of Satan. You know, that's a really, really harsh thing to say. It's something that I would never in a million years say except Jesus said it. You know, and so I have to say it. But I don't have I wouldn't have the guts to say that in a lot of settings. So there's just this whole issue where, yes, they're blind. Paul is agonizing for his countrymen according to the flesh, but at the same time, you know, and he says they're beloved for the sake of the fathers, even in their opposition, their enemies of the gospel. He says they're still beloved. At the same time, you've got Jesus saying, well, that synagogue that rejects me, they're under the control of Satan. Wow. So how you put that all together is really tough. But here's one of these places where, you know, wherein Jesus talks about, when he talks about these synagogues, he says, I will make them know that I have loved you, and they will come and bow and recognize that I love you, right? This is one of those passages right here where we're sitting here as Christians and we say, we know why there's a man on that throne. A form of a man, and we know who that is, and we have no right other than the Holy Spirit to be the ones that understand that passage. It's not our book. It's from thousands of years ago. It's from a whole different culture, a whole different place in the world. People who their religion is a huge part of their culture, and here we're sitting over here, a bunch of little bumpkins, and we've got the answer to this passage, and I can go to these expert books. And they just pass over it in silence, you know. And so that's that whole business again, where it's just, if this wasn't Christianity, you wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it. It's like we're sitting here reading the details of a nuclear submarine, and there's all these nuclear physicists around us, and they can't understand it, and we understand it. It's like, you guys are the experts. You're the nuclear physicist. We're just Joe Blows here on Kamano Island, and we understand what this reactor is about, and you don't have a clue. It doesn't make any sense without a spiritual dynamic. And that's the part that blows me away, is when you see those things and you realize where he talks about that the church would make the Jews jealous. We have a relationship with their Messiah that they can't see. We can see him in this passage. It's like, no way are you ever going to get him out of that passage. He's right in there. And yet, no comment in their study Bible. It's just like,
so did you find anything that they did say, you know, that was interesting of other verses?
Not a great deal. There's a couple things they have to say about, you know, noting the differences between these animals and the ones in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. But see, they don't draw on the New Testament at all, right? So we've got stuff in Revelation that helps us that they won't even look at. Right? And the four Gospels and the four faces, they're not going to make any correlation there, you know.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there was any.
What do they say about
the four faces?
Yeah.
And these books don't really give you much. Mm. You know, it's interesting because, you know, if you have like a MacArthur Study Bible, for instance, the notes in your MacArthur Study Bible are probably like 6 or 8 times more voluminous than a Jewish Study Bible. You know, that's not to say that if you were in a Jewish yeshiva looking at the writings of all the different rabbis going back, you'd probably have pages and pages of commentary, and I don't have that. But these Jewish Study Bible and this Tanakh by the Stone Guy, they're essentially trying to condense down the most important comments and put them in there. And time and time again, you'll come away with, you know, gosh, we have way more insight into your book than you guys do. You know? And, you know, some ways it's like, well, duh, that's what Paul says, not what the New Testament says. We shouldn't be surprised. It's me that's got the problem. I get surprised by it, you know? I'm looking back here and thinking, you know, because again, having gone to seminary and having had all these different teachers and stuff and all these books I'm drawing from and stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, 98% of these people, you know, there's a few exceptions, but most of them are not Jewish. And every once in a while you're thinking, well, you know, surely there must be some really valuable Jewish insight on this from, you know, non-believing Jews at least see something. And you go in there and it's just not, there's nothing much there, and it's surprising. Or, you know, I gave up on reading this book, I don't remember the title of it, but it's like what every Jew should know about Judaism. It's kind of like an encyclopedia by this fairly well-known rabbi again, and he's not Christian, but I thought, well, you know, I'll learn a bunch. And the first part was on the Old Testament, and I barely made it through it without throwing the book through the window because he either was like completely blind to basic stuff, even though he purportedly, you know, was saying he understood Christianity. He was completely blind and misrepresenting what we really know and teach, or he had goofy ideas like pagan, you know. And it's one of those things, like if you reject the truth of God, you can get off on some really strange thing. So anyway, so I barely made it through that, you know. And I was in section 2. There's like 3 sections. The section 2 is like historical things that Jews should know about. And I finally got like about halfway through the book, and it's a pretty big book. I have like 700 pages. And I told Debbie, I said, you know, this is really agony reading this book. She said, well, why are you reading it? And I thought, why am I reading?
Here you're reading the book that a non-believer wrote.
So I gave up and quit and gave the book away, you know. But
I don't know what I did
with
it.
Let's corrupt
somebody else.
No, I think he crashed it.
But so when you read, you know, so my... Really, all I'm saying here is that one of the things that we've seen happen to at least one woman we know is, and this is this whole Jewishness of the Bible thing. It's, if you don't recognize the Jewishness of the Bible, you're going to miss out on a lot. It's a Jewish book written primarily by Jews, and if you don't pick up on that, there's a lot you're going to lose out on. But non-believing Judaism can be dangerous for Christians because it has a lot in common with Christianity, and there's also this understanding, well, you know, they're experts at Hebrew, right? And so we have seen people that wound up focusing on Jewish sources to learn more about the Bible and end up being talked out of a belief that Jesus is the Messiah, and believing that Christians are distorting the Old Testament to pour Jesus in there.
Mm-hmm. So she became a convert.
So she became a Jew, essentially. Married a Jewish guy and converted to Judaism. But the thing is, a person like that isn't rooted well enough in the Bible mm-hmm. to see what the problems are with the claims that the Jews are making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were talking about the commentaries and stuff, and I read the commentary down here for
person of
Earth. MacArthur's commentary here, and it's talked about the faces, okay? Mm-hmm. And he said, these symbols identify the angels as intelligent man, powerful lion, servile bull, and swift eagle. Now, to me, these are kind of they tell you about an eagle, a lion, and everything, but it doesn't give you the significance of the four faces that are on there, you
mm-hmm.
know, that a person who is a believer should pick up, I think, that these are the attributes of Jesus Christ, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially the lion of Judah, and the eagle is the deity, and, you know, these things that are portrayed back in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering, why in the world would he do that?
Okay, well, yeah, so several answers there. One is he...
or might have not been him.
Right,
yeah,
and that's the first thing I would say is that it is the MacArthur Study Bible, and he would stand behind every comment in it, but John MacArthur himself didn't write all those notes.
I'm not saying this is wrong, but
no,
I'm not.
It doesn't go far enough.
Say necessarily that if these are attributes of an angel either.
Right.
I don't know that. But,
right.
He didn't skip it.
Yeah.
But,
so when you read something
it.
That somebody puts out like this, you
right,
think,
you
well, you
yeah.
no, you actually feel well. You want this person I'm dependent upon to get.
Well, you know, it's a whole situation. You know, every teacher will let you down somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're looking for. You're looking at the body. You want to look at the body of Christ, every resource that's in the body of Christ. And so there are some people where they'll have insights in certain areas, and they're stronger in some areas and weaker in other areas. And so, you know, you could go every study Bible. You pick up the Ryrie Study Bible. I've got the Baptist Study Bible by Criswell and Paige Patterson. And, you know, every one of those study Bibles you pick up and you read in there, there'll be quite a few places where they're just right on the line with each other, and then another places where one just seems to miss something that the others will see, and vice versa, or they'll have an opinion that's maybe a little unusual, and that's just kind of the nature of the game. I look back and I go, you know, virtually all of these people have have served Christ in just phenomenal ways. And that's kind of the way I look at it is, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, and God hasn't put all his insight in any one package.
I'm being too critical here.
Well, no.
When I look at this magnificent vision here, I'm thinking magnificent things, or trying to anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And I'm not thinking about little things like this is an attribute of an angel or something like that.
It's a good question,
you know.
and critically
mm-hmm.
think,
yeah.
because like Tony says, there's not all of them are going to be right on. And like you're saying, you know, Clinton, it's like it didn't go far enough. And like the angels, I'm like,
I just thought that there was just
everybody has
when
some
bone.
Yeah, there's always a bone here and there. You get it out.
Well, the other thing too.
I have one question though, Tony. You said that not all of the notes are by MacArthur in his study Bible.
They weren't originated by him,
Really?
Yeah.
That's news to me.
It's a production of the
Master's
Seminary faculty.
I thought they were all his notes over the years put into this and published by them. But you're saying that he maybe not is the author of all this.
Right.
I had no idea.
And
that's news.
So if you look at John MacArthur's specialty is the New Testament. I'm not saying he doesn't know the Old Testament. He's awesome.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying his specialty is the New Testament. He's taught through that a lot of times, and he's very adept at Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew, he he doesn't have nearly the background on Hebrew as he has on Greek.
So he might be relying on that.
And I'm saying that most all of these commentaries are not done by one person, mm-hmm. even though they have one person's imprimatur on them, essentially. Mm-hmm. Just like mm-hmm. Chuck Swindoll would be the key guy on one of the commentaries from Dallas Theological Seminary when he was the head of the seminary, but when you really go in there and look, it's a contribution of a bunch of different mm-hmm. people who specialize on certain books.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I just knew that he's over the years, just like you, you know, keep your notes and that you keep building and adding on to them.
Yeah.
And so I thought when he got to a certain place and then he will revise.
Yeah, I'll have to go and double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's what I've read.
That's definitely new to me. I assume it's all too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually John MacArthur and the faculty. Of the Master's Cemetery.
Cemetery. Yeah. Yeah. I have heard that term, you know, whatever, but right. for other books.
Now, I think there are differences. Like, you go to, like, the Schofield, the original Schofield, it was all C.I. Schofield, and the same with Ryrie, right. it was all Ryrie's notes, right?
right?
But I think the more elaborate productions today, and mm-hmm. MacArthur's would be one of them. I mean, one of the differences you'll see if you pick up the Ryrie Study Bible is a great study Bible. If you pick it up, it doesn't have nearly as much help in a lot of places as the MacArthur one would have.
Mm-hmm. But it's reliable for the most
part. Yeah, and they all have areas where they're stronger and weaker. Schofield has some insights mm-hmm. too, but then he has some other kind of dinosaur eggs or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
good to discern.
Yeah.
To think about those things.
But the thing I guess I'm saying here overall is this is one of those passages where the average Christian comes to this and sees this figure as a man there and makes connections that are valid connections that a lot of other people that are not born again won't make and can't make. And people will try to talk you out. They'll try to talk you into, you know, your understanding of this book is naive. What do you know about it, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, being born again with the Spirit, you actually understand these things that other, you know, and that's why, you know, whenever NPR or the History Channel or whatever, they get some pointy-headed expert on there who's not born again, you get the strangest answers. Yeah. But if you're not a Christian that understands this idea that bumpkins like us can understand this better than experts, well, comparatively we are. If we're not really convinced of that spiritual dynamic, then we can cause our beliefs to be challenged when we shouldn't be. We should just be holding firm to what we understand. And so this is one of those areas where you see this pop out in a big way.
5 minutes to bring it to a landing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Wow. I know. I was going, really?
Gosh, I must have really...
What's the color of barrel?
Brown. Most barrels are brown.
Barrel stays.
We need to.
And you know, I used to have this problem because we had a woman in our Bible study whose name was Burl.
Oh.
And I would say, and we're in Revelation.
Wow.
And I'd say the color of Burl, and she'd say, no, it's Burl. And I'd say, yeah, Burl, and she'd, no, that's not how it's pronounced. It's Burl.
No, you would say like
Burl. Well, you know what I mean? It was this like little subtle thing, and so I got to where I was paranoid to say that stone.
Right.
Because I wasn't quite sure how to say it, and whatever I said, it was not the way that she pronounced it.
Yeah.
And
she's in there with the net groups.
Mm-hmm. Sweet boy. So one question I was going to throw out here just to, so in chapter 2 we're going to see Ezekiel's commission essentially. And so one of the questions that comes up is, well, why did God, why does he appear in this this magnificent, glorious way to Ezekiel, why would he do that? He doesn't do that with every prophet, right? I mean, it's not real common.
They're all having the same kind of...
Because it's precursors to the time when he is on the throne. In other words, in the same way as the time period is capturing that he's seeing, is in the same way he's being presented with that vision.
I'm not sure I understand.
Maybe so Ezekiel just needed this magnificent vision in order to respond to him.
I'm not saying I know what the right answer is. I'm just asking the question to see what people thought.
Me, I would think that God prepared him to see this vision from a long time previous. Because you wouldn't, I don't care if you said you would be, we wouldn't be able to describe it, but he had some, I think God, that's what I'm going to say. God prepared him up to this, you know, to that point, so he could see this vision and describe it this way.
This was his starting as a prophet, right? This was the beginning of it. So I would think you're probably right. He needed to know this is from God. You know, this is from God. And
but there was no question.
He said, you shall say, thus saith the Lord, or thus saith God, I can't remember what, and they will know that you're a prophet. You know, so if the whole thing was the anointing of a prophet, I would say.
Well, I think about that whole thing about, you know, the man, appearance of a man in a rainbow, and then, you know, against a rainy day, and I'm thinking, well, that's, you know, a time period where it's a dark time.
Yeah, so he's in captivity.
Right.
Right, and he mentions that at the beginning, right?
Right, so I'm looking at that going, okay, there you are.
What would happen?
A contrast that's appropriate for his time period and maybe the prophetic time period as well. Both.
Yeah.
You know, it's a depiction of the time and the chronology.
So, like, if the Chinese attacked tonight, took over America, ransacked all the Christian churches, hauled us all off somewhere, what are some of the things we'd be thinking? I mean, Ezekiel, Jerusalem got attacked, hasn't been ransacked yet, but he's hauled off, and Israel's under the thumb. He's captive.
You mean? You mean to give him hope in the midst of the dark times?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's potentially this issue of when you are the religious superpower that God's behind, supposedly, right? Jerusalem and the throne of David and everything, and another power has come in and taken over and hauled you all away. You know, one of the questions you're going to be asking a lot is, well, where's God? Right? Where's God? And then, you know, when we look at his commissioning, you know, God is definitely emphasizing that these people aren't going to listen to you, essentially. Right?
Yeah, like Jeremiah.
So I think some of it, when you look at the historical situation, it's a situation where it looks like God has abandoned Israel, and it also, he's going to call Ezekiel into a ministry that's like, Ezekiel, come bang your head on the concrete for 30 years.
It's like Jeremiah.
Yeah. So there's a sense in which the difficulty of the mission, you know, would relate to that glory as well. The fact that, you know, that he's seen the decision of God. But I think also, you know, like we talked about before, a big part of what he's going to tell Ezekiel about is the depart his departure of his glory from the temple, from Israel, and the reappearance of it later on. So there's a sense in which if he's going to show him the departure of his glory and the return of his glory, then he's
there's the return.
8:30.
then he has to show him what his glory is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
There's, you know, it's almost like if he just jumped to chapter 10 and all of a sudden Ezekiel's seeing this in the context of what we'll see in chapter 10 or whatever, it's like too much all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So there's a sense in chapter 10 when this amazing thing appears again. I mean, I'm not saying that Ezekiel's bored, but he could say, oh, it's God again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, what did he do? I mean, he fell down on his face, and God had to give him the spirit to get up, you know, even. So if he didn't see all this magnificent stuff to begin with, he might have a heart attack and die or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
well, it's like John in chapter 1 of Revelation. He gets the vision of Christ.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I go by this. With anybody that God uses less mightily, he prepared Moses, he prepared everything. All those guys all were prepared for a long period of time before it actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And each of them, you know, if like Moses, he saw God's glory in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, later he asked God to show him his glory, you know. But there's that whole business. And then you've got Peter, Paul, and
Mary.
That's a
beautiful
story.
Ringo.
John. Peter, Paul, and John.
I didn't know they were there.
But anyway, on the Mount of Transfiguration. So,
did that bug you?
Find that.
But you know, on the Mount of Transfiguration, the same sort of thing. The guys who are closest, God, it's like he knows what they're going to face down the road. And so he gives them a special manifestation of his glory. You know, just like Moses, the burning bush. Here you've got this. John, Revelation 1, he sees Jesus in his glorified representation. And again, he's overwhelmed. So it seems like Sid is saying, you know, this whole business of when these people have a really difficult or precarious ministry, he gives them a huge dose of magnificence, you know, exposure to his magnificence, or Isaiah in Isaiah 6, you know, he gives them this dose of his magnificence because he knows they're going to need it, like you were referring to that too, mm-hmm. This whole idea that...
That's kind of what I was going to say, is that anytime, and it just seems to me, like if you read through scripture, just take it all as a, in like a bigger picture, mm-hmm. like a big, just look at it all at the big picture. Anytime God shows up personally, something serious is about to happen. You know, like when he would show up, when he showed up with Moses and all, and you know, Israel, and then and all, whenever he showed up with one of the judges,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then with one of the kings or anybody after that, you know, anytime God shows up personally or does something really out of the ordinary, it means he has something really special in mind or hard in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in like the apostles, like you were saying, and then Paul, of course,
on the road to Damascus, another good example. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, anytime God shows up himself, you know, personally, he comes and, you know, taps somebody on the shoulder or whatever it is. He does it because there's something that he needs to get done right away, or, you know, has something specific in mind for this person to do, and he knows they're not going to do it unless they know it, that he's the one setting them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other comments or thoughts before we close the prayer?